A Not My President rally on the President's Day holiday yesterday drew a crowd of more than 1,000 people to the downtown Capitol District to protest President Donald Trump's actions in his second term. The participants wore their hearts on their signs for teachers, federal workers, transgender youth, minorities, for climate change, and more. Their displeasure was aimed at President Donald Trump and Elon Musk and the GOP. The crowds lined both sides of the streets and spilled down part of two blocks. Lisa Gibson is with the group Indivisible, which helped to organize the grassroots rally.
Its mission was to defy Trump's agenda of misogyny, racism, and authoritarianism. We did that by going to our members of Congress's office every Tuesday for 2 years until COVID hit. Then our tactics changed, and we did 180,000 postcards to swing states written by people in Hawaii. And with the loss of the last election, we are back to defying Trump's agenda of misogyny, racism, and authoritarianism.
This is quite a turnout today.
Yes, and it isn't just Indivisible. This is lots of groups coming together. This is a group called 50-51, 50 states, 50 capitals, one movement. We are part of a growing coalition of defenders of democracy from across the country. Don't you dare take my democracy away from me, Donald Trump or Elon Musk. Don't you dare even think about it.
So I'm hearing outrage as I walk up in front of the Capitol on both sides of the street. It's pretty incredible. It's a throwback to, the 60s.
Well, it's not a drill. There's a coup d'etat happening. And of course, they're coming after NPR. And you may not know this, but I was one of the people who started Hawaii Public Radio, raised the money for the first Capitol campaign. So it's near and dear to my heart. But it's an assault on the Constitution to take away the free press. That is happening, along with many, many other assaults against the Constitution. And it is up to us, we the people, to speak up. We are the barrier. And the Supreme Court's gonna hear a lot of these cases. The courts actually are doing a pretty good job standing up to Trump. They're all gonna get to the Supreme Court. And we need to hold our Supreme Court accountable. And if they fail, then we're gonna have to get louder. We're gonna have to get louder.
And there was a gathering a couple of weeks ago, I think about 200 people. I don't know, today it's more like 2,000.
Yeah, that was the first time this organic group 50-51 came out. And it was something on Reddit, and it's taking off. It's absolutely taking off. So this is what democracy looks like.
And I understand that there are a number of other protests that are being planned as we speak.
Let me see if I can get this off the top of my head. I believe on the 28th, they're asking people to do no shopping for 24 hours, zero shopping. There's one coming up to do, and we'll publish this on our website. Don't buy anything on Amazon for a week, not anything on Amazon for a week. So these kinds of rapid actions are going to keep proliferating, and we have to stand up. Of, by, and for the people is what democracy is all about. And nobody's going to rescue us. We have to rescue ourselves.
Walking through this crowd, there were some pro-Trump supporters here.
Yeah.
Things were getting pretty heated between the people here this morning.
I would say there were a half a dozen of them and how many thousands of us. So that's okay. They can do whatever they want. It's free country. They can do it. Well, at the moment, it's free. And if we don't stand up, we could lose that.
Anything else you want to say just about this gathering or how long you plan to?
Well, if you're looking for information, look up indivisiblehawaii.org. You can find information there. You can also go to indivisible.org national and find out what's going there, because these rapid actions are going to keep proliferating the more outrageous the attack on democracy becomes. And we are the barrier, we the people.
Gibson says she hopes this will be the beginning of pushback and activism that would pull the community together as it tries to channel the energy of stress during this time. Are you anxious? Take a deep breath and exhale. Anne Botticelli is with a newly formed group, Allies in Resistance, or AIR. It's planning another gathering on March 1st. While it says there is much to resist, it has diversity, equality, and inclusion in its focus. Botticelli says she and fellow organizers, former Domestic Violence Action Center Director Nancy Creedman and Democratic Party political insider Chuck Friedman, are doing what they can to grow the movement.
We call our group Allies in Resistance. It's really a collective that we're trying to gather of people who I think feel urgency about what do we do now in this time. And we've picked up on this vibration that people are wondering, how do I act? How do I make my resistance known? And so Allies in Resistance is going to be a collective of our allies' allies, to pull together and be present. We have an Instagram page, it's called allies_in_resistance. That's going to be a place where we can, I think, share information, share fact-checking, share our presence, get together as community, and let people know what it is they can do in this time to resist and push against some of what's happening.
So you are organizing a protest on March 1st?
It's a march and a rally. We want to pay homage to Patsy Mink. Patsy Mink was the first woman of color in Congress. She was the architect of Title IX and a voice behind it. I think she really represents some of the best things about Hawaii, the idea that you can go up and have a voice, and you don't look like everybody else, but you make your voice heard, and you change things based on your perspective and what you know. She's a champion of it. So we thought she would be perfect to sort of honor that day as we make our way from Iolani Palace around the state capitol and back to the palace. And then we'll have a roster of speakers that can talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion and what's at stake in today's environment. You know, I think we talked about it, Chuck and Nancy and I, and we thought there's so much going on. We're being flooded every day with a new assault, a new thing that's under attack, whether it's science funding or education, DEI. And we thought, well, maybe the best thing we can do to not get so distracted is to focus on something that is very important and I think really meaningful here in Hawaii, where we have a wonderful blended society. We're not perfect, but we sort of lead the way in that area. So we decided to focus on DEI first, with the idea that there are going to be other groups that are forming around other things that we can coalesce with and stand shoulder to shoulder with. And together, we'll form that wall of resistance that I think is important to form.
So this turnout today is pretty impressive.
It's very impressive. And as I walked through, I saw so many people I know, and they all said the same thing that we've been feeling, which is, we're just wondering, what can we do? And Senator Brian Schatz on a podcast the other day said something like, what you can do is show up in three dimensions. You know, show up in person, demonstrate your anxiety over this. And so that's what I think people are doing, and I think that's what's appropriate to do right now. And I really feel like this anxiety has momentum behind it, you know, and it's a wave that we can catch to push back, to say no, to say this is not what we stand for.
Channeling that energy.
Exactly. Catching that wave. Catching the air in the wave.
We have been hearing from Allies in Resistance and Indivisible, two groups who say they are part of a movement to resist the White House orders as it looks to shrink the federal government and align it with Republican policies.
Support for HPR comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits offering workforce housing solutions for young Kama'aina training to become farmers, such as the Waianae Community Redevelopment Corporation. NereidHawaii.com.
Since World War II, most German political parties have sworn off cooperation with the far right, a norm that holds the memory of the Holocaust at its center.
And when we say never again, you have to know, what is it never again? You cannot erase the history.
How Germany's changing political landscape could upend that norm, next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from Leeward Theater. Na Le Hulu Ika Veikiu performs Kupu Kupu, a new production featuring musical twists, March 15th and 16th. Leeward.hawaii.edu/theater.
Leaders from the U.S. and Russia are meeting today in Saudi Arabia to talk about ending the Ukraine conflict. Ukraine isn't at the table, and neither are any of our European allies. That triggered an emergency meeting among European leaders to talk about the relations in the region. We did talk to the United Kingdom's defense representative as tensions were rising. Mark Newton's title is defense minister at the British Embassy in D.C. The U.K. was one of 26 nations represented at a defense conference last week organized by the Pacific Forum. It had, for the first time, the largest contingent of European countries due to the tensions over the Ukrainian war. Newton acknowledged the tensions created with the new administration.
The UK is a very firm supporter of us having a free and open Indo-Pacific. We are currently in the middle of the Strategic Defence Review, which the new Labour government initiated when it came into power. I expect, without wanting to, you know, prejudge its conclusions, that it will continue to talk about our principal threat being from Russia. We see that, you know, at the moment in Ukraine. But it will talk about the need for us to do our part to make sure that there is a free and open Indo-Pacific too. And we do see a kind of indivisibility between the Euro-Atlantic and the Indo-Pacific theatres. We see, you know, Russia increasingly active here. We see, you know, China and Chinese technology play sometimes an unhelpful role in Europe. And we're therefore keen to be a part of the conversations here about how Europe can play its part in the Indo-Pacific.
This is an interesting time because you've got the transition with a new administration. It's a bit unsettling with some of our allies not being involved in some of the talks with Ukraine, as we've seen this past week. But how are you looking at this transition?
So we work very closely with kind of all administrations here, and we make sure we endure the special relationship going forward as we have for decades in the past. We've actually had a pretty constructive week in Europe. So the UK chaired the Ukraine Donor Coordination Group, and Secretary Hegseth attended that throughout. We've had a number of bilateral meetings in the margins of that conversation. We've had a NATO defense ministerial meeting, and the Munich Security Conference is going on. And again, there have been plenty of things said in open forum, but there have been a number of other candid conversations in private, which I'm afraid I can't get into here.
It is making for, you know, interesting times because of the discussions that are being had at this conference. I think maybe some of the allies aren't sure. What can we count on? Who can we trust? What are your thoughts on that?
I think that the UK has a very deep and enduring defence relationship with the United States, and I expect us to be able to continue to be the United States' principal ally in Europe, continue to be its strongest partner in NATO. And I expect that we will continue to work with the United States on the challenges that we face all around the world. I think one of the things that we've heard at this conference is consternation about growing collaboration between some of our adversaries. If you look at what North Korea is doing to support Russia in Ukraine, that's a pretty troubling indicator and a sign of that indivisibility between the Euro-Atlantic and the Indo-Pacific that I spoke about. I think we've heard reassuring noises both in the halls here and also in the margins of those conversations in Europe. I know people like to get nervous about some of what they hear, but actually I'm pretty reassured that the relationship between the UK and the US will continue to be very strong.
As far as the concern about USAID and some of the concerns that folks might have about having one less tool to strengthen relationships among our partners here in the Pacific, how are you folks looking at that?
Well, the UK went through its own process of merging our International Development Department with our Foreign Office to create our Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office just in the last few years. I think the important thing will be to see, you know, what comes out of this process. I don't want to judge it in the middle of it. There are an awful lot of programs and an awful lot of money, and you know, there are always examples of where money can be better spent. I mean, definitely in defense, that is true. But I don't want to prejudge the outcome of the work that's currently going on until we've seen what the conclusions are.
And then what about as far as just trade and economics? I mean, you know, because we've got a lot of defense contractors here looking not just for domestic work and contracts, but possibly even abroad, you know, talks about submarines, that kind of thing. But yeah, how do you look at that?
Sure. I mean, the UK is very keen to work with partners in the region on a range of industrial initiatives. The two that are probably best known are the AUKUS initiative that we have with Australia and the US. It's how you get the UK and the US in the otherwise slightly odd word. And the Global Combat Air Program that we work collaboratively with the Italians and the Japanese on. With AUKUS in particular, we're working both on submarines and undersea technology and a whole range of advanced capabilities. And it's important that we have an open and a transparent conversation with industry about all of that. And we've had a number of sessions here talking about what AUKUS is doing, what it might do in the future, offering our kind of gratitude for the changes to export control reforms that Congress passed through in the last year or so, and looking to see what more we can all do together.
Do you agree with Admiral Paparo's assertion that, you know, there's a sense of urgency and we can't afford to wait?
I definitely agree that we need to do everything we can to make sure that we have got a free and an open Indo-Pacific. And, you know, I think it's important that we continue to have those conversations in public and in private, which is what we've been doing here.
And that was Mark Newton, Defense Minister at the British Embassy in Washington, D.C. We also received this voicemail from a listener in response to our coverage last week on the defense conference and Admiral Sampaparo's keynote speech. Danny Lee from KL from the Big Island shared his opinion.
You know, the whole narrative is so ridiculous. It's absolutely amazing. One-sided. Talking constantly about the threat from China. It's ridiculous. You read every statement from the Chinese side. They always say the world is a big place. We can do a win-win situation for everybody. They've never said they want to threaten any, and their actions have not shown anything like that. But, you know, these people are, you know, using the admiral, I guess, who talked yesterday, Paparo, you know, it's super war hawk. It's a one-way narrative about a threat from China when there's no such thing. The whole threat comes from this side of the Pacific. So I seriously think that that's, you know, very biased. And in the future segment, I think you should have at least, you know, a little bit of the other side. This is just unbelievable. It's not good reporting at all.
We do appreciate the feedback. If you have comments to share, call our TalkBack line, 808-792-8217, or send us an email at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Former U.S. Ambassador Jim Moriarty is a longtime Hawaii resident. He took part in the Pacific Forum's Defense Conference in Waikiki last week. Moriarty served as U.S. Ambassador to Nepal and Bangladesh, but has extensive experience in China and Taiwan. He shared his personal insights into the current political climate and the move to dismantle the federal agency USAID.
I tell people that I hear of this paradigm that the military frequently uses, which is DIME, and the D stands for diplomacy, the I stands for information, the M stands for military, and I like to think of that as security, and the last one is E, economics. And if you look at economics, trade, aid, investment, these are the sorts of tools you have, and when you take away that aid pillar, you are limiting the tools that you can use as you try to influence other powers. I mean, this whole conference that we're at right now is all about, you know, deterrence of powers that might want to do the U.S. and its interests harm. And to do that, you need to work with other countries as effectively as possible. And in many countries, that does have AID plays an important role. You know, they do provide access, they do provide goods. They do provide goods for the American people, too. For example, you know, working against infectious diseases, helping the people of various countries have better livings. And what that means, less illegal immigration. When you peel it all back, if you can have a decent life in your own country, fewer people try to get out, either legally or illegally. So it's, you know, it's a critical tool in many countries where we have accomplished a lot of good. But frankly, your relationship is always evolving. And as a former ambassador, it would have been much tougher for me if I was not able, when I was working in countries that were relatively poor and looked up to the United States in many ways, it would have been harder to work in those places without my ability to use assistance to help build that country, to help increase stability in the region. And I will quickly add here that stability in virtually any region in the world is in the American national interest. Stability is like, I guess, instability is a better way of putting it, is like throwing a rock in a lake. The ripples start going every place and you have no control over how long they will go. So you have to be very careful when you take away these tools of deterrence, including our aid relationships with many countries.
I think of the Philippines, because we are coming up on, I believe, the 80th anniversary, you know, of the war, and they're going to mark that. And, you know, with the tensions in the Pacific region with China and those islands, you just wonder, you know, because USAID provides funds, to your point, to strengthen poorer countries.
I actually think the Philippines is interesting because our relationship isn't evolving so quickly and so positively. You know, and in a way, the Philippines are kind of following countries like Thailand and Malaysia, where you're getting more prosperous all the time. And frankly, a lot of the things that AID has been working on in the Philippines has paid off. You know, you've got a really strong civil society, and part of that credit goes to AID that does really good things. They have worked to help open up the government to more external supervision. So in a way, you know, I might be being too optimistic here. I would hope that in maybe 8 to 10 years, the Philippines would no longer be a traditional aid recipient. And that's exactly what aid is trying to do every place in the world, is work itself out of a job. They're not there to be a permanent presence. They're there because a specific country has specific issues that do affect American interests and therefore should get some help in addressing those problems.
You know, we're in an interesting time with the situation with Ukraine, and there's some thought about, okay, what are the lessons learned with the conflict over there on that side of the world and any conflict that might emerge in the Western Pacific?
There's lots of lessons learned, and a lot of them, frankly, are, you know, the topics of this conversation, which is, it's not really aid, but it's how do you cooperate beforehand and build the muscle memory of cooperation with partners in the region? Having spent so much time in Taiwan, I obviously look at cross-strait issues between China and Taiwan very closely. And as you look at it, as China has a law that says they have sovereignty over Taiwan, and they're justified in using force whenever they decide that peaceful unification is not going to happen. Under those conditions, we need to be working closely with Taiwan and with its neighbors to prevent an outbreak of warfare across the Taiwan Strait, or what they call gray zone tactics, that cyber attacks, disinformation, large-scale military exercises, trying to set the stage either for an attack itself or to so intimidate and discourage the people in Taiwan and their neighbors that everybody will just let a forced unification happen. So we've got to be working with and collaborating with the countries in the region. We have to be looking at things like, you know, how does, to be honest, one of the themes here is that this defense industrial base that has atrophied in the United States has atrophied in most of the other democracies. How do you work together, build a common interest? Yeah, I'm not going to call China a common enemy, but it's obviously a common concern. If you look back at that dime metal, diplomacy is really important and information is very important. And frankly, that also ties into the military, you know, the security aspects. If China realizes that the Philippines, the Japan, Australia, they all understand that peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait is crucial, that begins discouraging something adventurous. If they realize that those countries and Taiwan itself are rebuilding their materials, rebuilding their defense industrial base, and are cooperating together and coming up with better plans for defense, that's a powerful deterrent. So it all ties in together, and then you get back to the economic issue. I do think that it's unfortunate that both parties seem to agree that right now we have to concentrate revitalizing American industry to the extent that we ignore trade entirely, because trade can be a powerful tool for, you know, lessening costs for American consumers. It also, if managed correctly, can build lots of opportunities for American jobs, American manufacturing geared to exports, not geared solely to internal consumption.
Not just domestic.
Yeah, and that's a win-win solution.
You know, with diplomacy, you know, a lot of this is based around trust. And we built a lot of trust with our allies. And these days, you know, with the headlines, people are saying, well, we thought we could trust you. Who can we trust now?
Well, this is going to sound cold-hearted, but frankly, who else can they trust? America plays a vital role in the world right now. And I haven't heard anybody say we're abandoning that role. Absent that, you know, if you look at the countries that Admiral Paparo called out the other night, and sometimes are kind of cutely called the crink countries, China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, no functioning democracy can look for anything except cyber attacks.
They're troublemakers.
They're troublemakers. And so the U.S. plays a vital role. I don't see us abandoning that. We're not tearing apart our alliances. You can see that by the participation here. You can also see that in the things that Secretary Rubio has made very clear. And frankly, his first couple of days where he met with the countries in the Australia, UK, US submarine building consortium, and then talked to the Japanese and the Filipinos too. I think he's all in making sure that our alliances in the Western Pacific, in East Asia, remain strong and remain a powerful deterrent.
That was retired U.S. Ambassador James Moriarty talking to us at the Honolulu Defense Forum last week.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Honolulu Waldorf School.
Big Island. Join Hawaii Public Radio at Kahilu Theater on Friday, March 21st for a live taping of The Conversation and Kanikapila Sunday. We talk story with author and longtime Parker Ranch veterinarian Dr. Billy Bergen, UH Biology Professor Patrick Hart of Manu Minute, and Hilo singer-songwriter Kainane Kahaunaile. For more information, visit hprtickets.org, sponsored by Merriman's Restaurants and Big Island Coffee Roasters.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. For today's backyard quiz, we're talking about the first lawyer in the nation to pass the bar exam by taking it in Braille. Did you know he's from Hawaii? Born premature in 1948, this future lawyer was put into an incubator as an infant. The experience caused him to lose his sight. And as a kid, he said no one wanted to put on their sports teams. So he spent all of his free time learning to play the piano. He became so good, he paid for college by playing gigs at local venues. As an undergraduate at the University of Hawaii, he met a young woman named Penny, who would soon become his wife. The couple moved to San Francisco, where he passed the bar exam in 1973. Still, when they returned home, it proved difficult to get work as a blind lawyer, so he started his own firm in 1976. He eventually became a prosecutor, which kicked off a career in politics. But in 1982, he made his first run for the Hawaii House of Representatives. For today's quiz, can you tell us the name of the first lawyer to pass the bar exam in Braille? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. Pick up a reusable HPR tote bag if you're the first one to get it right.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for young farmers seeking a future in agriculture, such as the Waianae Community Redevelopment Corporation. NareitHawaii.com.
Honolulu Civil Beat has a story today about the spread of an invasive pest, the coconut rhinoceros beetle. Reporter Thomas Heaton joins us today to talk about where it's doing damage in the urban core. Good morning, Thomas.
Good morning, Catherine. Thank you for having me.
Yes, it's been a while since we chatted, and you've been on the bug beat lately.
You
had a story yesterday on the anemones in Kaneohe Bay, but this one on the beetle, so they're just right around the corner from our studios.
Yes, they are. They have made their presence known in urban Honolulu for, I guess, really the first time, at least through damage. When we received a tip last week from a reader concerned about some damage that they saw around some trees at the Victoria Place condominium complex near Ala Moana Beach Park and Kiwalo Basin Harbour there. So we went down, had a look, and we reached out to Mike Melzer at the University of Hawaii's CRB response. He's the man to know when it comes to CRB with coconut rhinoceros beetles. He's been working on this issue since late 2013 when it first arrived here and when it was first detected, actually, at the Joint Base Pearl Harbor Hickam.
Yes, and I remember when they had a big news conference out there, and they showed us how they had cut down all those trees on the golf course, and were really doing their darnest to keep that contained. And they did for a while, but the news that it's in Kaka'ako, it comes at an interesting time because I just saw that Howard Hughes just opened up that park over there where they have all those new palm trees, the new coconut trees put in.
Yeah, so Keith Weiser, who's also on that CRB response team, said that they haven't detected, or they've barely detected, any beetles east of the airport since they cut down all those trees out near the airport. So, yeah, that's the kind of the chief suspicion here, because both Keith Weiser and Mike Melzer at the University of Hawaii said that there's both fresh and old damage to the trees. So what the chief suspicion here is that, you know, in bringing these trees into this beautiful new park, the coconut beetles hitchhiked along with them. So there's the old damage, and then it's suspected that the beetles hitchhiked along, and then they also, you know, they got a bit hungry, so they started going for other trees that were previously established.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think one of the lines in your story is like they're like termites now, right? They're just eating trees like nobody's business.
Yeah, and really I think what Mike's getting at there is that we've had coconut rhinoceros beetle here on Oahu for more than a decade now. Haven't been able to resolve the issue, unfortunately. So they're like termites now, so they're kind of people's responsibility to look after Because, of course, in 2023, that was when when invasive species experts said to the state, hey, look, we can't eradicate them from the island. And we're going to have to just manage them. So, yeah, they're taking kind of termite status. They're the landowner's responsibility to look after. And unfortunately, they don't really care if you're the state, a private landowner, or if you're renting renting a property. It's kind of everyone's responsibility to contain this issue.
Yeah, I mean, it's a shame because, like I said, they've got those new trees in and, you know, already seeing some damage that they're being attacked. But they're a difficult pest to get rid of. I mean, I've seen, you know, attempts to try and put netting, you know, around the crowns. You know, they can inject it with some pesticides, but those guys are nasty. They're very ferocious looking, and the little larvae are gross, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, they most certainly aren't really a sight for sore eyes. The thing that makes coconut rhinoceros beetles so prevalent is, well, of course, they breed so well, but then also they travel far. You know, they have a 2-mile flight radius for each day, so that really puts Waikiki and kind of into the crosshairs for this beetle, which I guess is, you know, a pretty big major concern for the tourism industry as well.
Oh yeah, if this gets all the way down into Waikiki, not good.
Mm-hmm. No, it's So I think that, you know, there's going to be some more news to come out of this. I'm not entirely sure how much of a problem this will be. I've been told that by some of the experts that this is moderately concerning. They're unsure yet whether this is just one or two pesky beetles or if these beetles could maybe bed down somewhere in Ala Moana Beach Park and breed and then, you know, bed down there. And then, of course, once they're established, they're even harder to get rid of.
Right. Well, thank you for bringing this to our attention, Thomas. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Catherine.
And that was Honolulu Civil Beat reporter Thomas Heaton. You can read his story online at civilbeat.org.
Support for HPR comes from the University of Hawaii Foundation. Its 4UH for Hawaii campaign connects donors with UH to fuel innovation and entrepreneurship across the islands. UHFoundation.org.
At All Things Considered, what unites all our conversations is curiosity.
Is he a good hugger?
Whether we're speaking to an aid worker.
What would you want them to know or understand about what you all are dealing with?
A scientist.
But what's in it for the dolphins?
Or a foreign leader.
If I may, I will ask the questions.
Feels by these right beliefs.
I will ask the questions.
Questions and answers. Every day on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Beginning this afternoon at 4, following Fresh Air.
HPR is supported by everyday people who give what they can. $5 a month is enough to become an HPR member. Support the news and music you rely on. Donate today at hawaiipublicradio.org.
He maluo kaulu pale.
Singer and songwriter Kalani Pea recently took home another Grammy Award. His first came in 2017 for his debut album, E Walea, which was recognized as the best regional roots music album. Pea's fourth Grammy comes for Kuini, his latest effort that explores everything from Pea's Mahu identity to reflections on how the 2023 fires changed Lahaina. Pea spoke from his home on Maui with the Conversation's D.W. Gibson.
It's my fourth Grammy Award on my fourth Hawaiian album, and I'm just so grateful to represent my kupuna, my ancestors and forefathers, my makua, my parents who have shaped who I am today, my family, my friends, fans, and the community I love. I'm just so grateful to be part of this. In Hawaiian, we call it kaiaulu, this community, this music community that I'm so close with.
Well, and you gave your acceptance speech in Alelo, and I wonder if you could tell our listeners about what you said and about your decision to deliver this speech in Alelo.
Mai moku o ke ave, I maui nui a ka mau, pana ewa I ka uanui ki o ka, ka aina ho o pula pula. A I ka aina o kaulana pupu o hele, ka hele lani. E ia hoi au, e ho hano hano, me ia me ho hano ana. Aloha kako, aloha!
I had to naturally olelo Hawaii at the beginning of my acceptance speech in front of tens of thousands of people in the audience and millions of people watching online to let the world know that the Hawaiian language is not dead. To let the world know that the language is thriving and that there are 20,000 plus speakers out there. And I'm amongst the 20,000 that olelo Hawaii. So I had to olelo Hawaii to acknowledge the language of my kupuna, the language that's been here for thousands of years. It's the language that I hold dear to my heart, where I compose about people and places I love in Hawaii, and it's the language of my heart.
Well, tell us a little bit about the album. Is there a song or two that feels particularly meaningful to you that you might want to put on the radar of listeners who haven't yet had the chance to listen to the album?
Every song is unique for me. If you want to say which is my favorite, I think it's the title track, Queenie.
E ku'ulei aloha o ka hele langi. Mai pu'u vai, vai pahe ka vaine.
Queenie means queen, and I honor the women, the goddesses, and those who have shaped my Hawaiian identity on this album.
I wonder if there's a song on this particular album that was harder to write, or maybe the flip side of that coin, any songs that came easily to you that felt like they were just waiting there for you to find them.
I have to say, one of them that's been so emotional for me to compose and release was Malu Ulua Olele. It's a song for the people of Lahaina. And living on Maui, we had to deal with the horrendous wildfires, 2023. I have loved ones that lost everything and loved ones that stayed at my house here during the fires. And I had to write that song a year and a half later. People be like, why did you take a year later to write a song? Why didn't you get inspired that day of? It was a pivotal moment for me to understand that this was a change for Maui. When I wrote this song, I had to honor these special name places. We call it in Hawaiian, Wahipana. I wanted to honor these special places where the Hawola rock was seen, a rock that the royal women will give birth to their children. It's a sacred place called Hawola. I would also go and visit Waiola Church. We also call it Waiola Waine'e Church, where our ali'i dwell and where our kings and queens were buried there. The church is gone today because of the fires. I had to honor Kiha Wahine, the Mo'o goddess, the protector of Moku'ula Island, Mokuhinia. And for those who don't know, Lahaina had a plethora of water. It was known for wetlands before the illegal water diversions and channelizations of our waters. I honor the plethora of water, the abundance of that land, the lush beauty of Lahaina. So to me, that song was very emotional for me to compose, because writing all the lyrics gave me snapshots of these places that was once there before. Places where I would find healing, places where I would reconnect spiritually with my kupuna, with our ali'i. And so I went back recently to see the land. It's such a different vibration. This song and the lyrical movement and arrangement of this song truly defines the people and the landscape of Lahaina. So Malu Ulua Olele is a very special song to me.
When you get to that moment, when you're able to write such an emotionally packed song, does it just burst out quickly, or is it still a grind to find the exact wording, the exact mood that you want?
It's sometimes it comes out naturally, my friend. And I really, in a Hawaiian perspective, we follow our na'au. People call it butterfly feeling. Us as the na'au, whatever, when we get this gut feeling sensation, I call it the whispers of our kupuna. And I think that's more of an eloquent way of saying, I just follow my na'au. And that's how I start the process of writing something that starts from the heart, starts from the gut, starts from the piko. And that's where the inspiration starts.
Always as a response to the world around you, right? The aina and the world around you.
You are pololei, my friend. I come from a family of, my last name is Pe'a, which means the sailboat. I come from a family of fishermen and musicians, but I surely didn't take the bait route. No, a'ole. I took the musician's route, my friend. at 4 years, 3-4 years old. I started singing and playing music around that age. After serenading a mannequin in Kaiko'omau and Hilo, my mom goes, oh my gosh, this kid loves music. So my journey took off from that point on.
If you're serenading mannequins, how can your parents say no to you?
I know. I was at JCPenney's and I ran away from them and I saw this mannequin and I was like, I can show you the world. Seeking a whole new world from Aladdin, brother. My mom and dad goes, okay, you're not playing sports. This kid loves singing. Okay, we're going to put you through Kamalani Children's Choir. Okay, we're going to get you vocal training. You're going to learn how to play the guitar. But that's where my journey started. I looked at this mannequin and go, I'm going to serenade you one day. And 41 today, selling out shows, sharing Hawaiian music with award-winning hula, the hula that tells a story through my music. It's a full circle for me, my friend. I cry on stage after I sing a song about my grandmother who suffered from Alzheimer's and passed away from Alzheimer's. I compare her to her favorite flower, the gardenia flower. My music can relate to people who too have dealt with those who lost, they lost those from dementia and Alzheimer's. And they're like, your song connects with me. And to me, that's the biggest accolade. Whether I'm at Carnegie Hall or I'm performing at Lincoln Center or on stage at the Grammy Awards in 2022 when I performed at the Grammys, I said the biggest accolade is not the Grammy Award itself or the Hoku Award. The accolade is embracing the fans and friends who can relate with my music, who can say, your song touched me in this way because you talked about your mother or grandmother or your father or your grandfather. This affects me. To me, that is the biggest reward, is making that pilina. In Hawaiian, we call it that connection through my music.
Well, February is Black History Month, and I know that there's a new album coming out that celebrates contributions of artists of African descent in post-contact Hawaiian history. You've contributed to that project. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Ai mahalo kumuhula mahelani uchiama. We love you. She's a wonderful hula instructor. She comes from the African-American descent, and she's an award-winning kumuhula. And she said, Kalani, I'm doing a project called Popolo Heno, cherishing our beautiful African-American Kanaka who resided in Hawaii, who have contributed to the monarchy, who have worked in politics, who were in civic and civil duties, who had koleana in our community here in Hawaii. Would you like to compose and be part of this album and sing? I said, of course. I said, you know, I have a person in mind. I really love this person. He is Popolo. He is of African-American descent, my brother from another mother. I love him, and his name is Kamaka Kehau Fernandez. He's a falsetto singer. He is this Popolo baby that came from Arkansas and raised by a Hawaiian family, the Nai'ole family. And the Nai'ole family, they reside here on Maui, and he's a Maui boy. Got his first hoku winning recognition from one of his albums, his debut albums, and he's one of his most beautiful performers. So I had to compose a song about our relationship as friends and talk about this beautiful Black boy, this Popolo boy who was raised in this beautiful Hawaiian family and hanai into the family. And now he is a Hawaiian language speaker. He's a Hawaiian immersion graduate like myself. He's a beautiful falsetto singer. So I had to be part of Kumu Mahelani Uchiyama's journey. I have to, because she collaborates a lot with me during my shows. In fact, we have my concerts coming up in Tracy and Carmel by the Sea at the end of this month. And she and her halau is part of it. And guess what? I'm singing the song. It's a debut performance in California for her project, and for Kamaka Kehau. So I'm very honored to be part of this wonderful Popolo Heno project.
Well, I mean, it sounds like you're keeping plenty busy in the wake of your Grammy win. Is there anything else you'd like to tell listeners at this point or let them know about what you're working on?
Well, you know, being mahu and being proud, coming from a loving family who allows me to be my authentic self through my art, I want to encourage our little young boys and girls, or however they identify themselves as part of my community, our mahu community, to be true to yourself. And if you want to be a Hawaiian opera singer or rap in Hawaiian and do hip hop in Hawaiian and be you, follow your dreams and heart and work towards those little objectives in your life. Write down your objectives to reach that ultimate goal and never allow anyone to define who you are. I will always remember what my grandparents would say. If you're a good person, people will be good to you. Just be a good person. Oyo vale. Mahalo for this time and consideration, and mahalo for sharing my musical journey. He leo aloha, he vahi mahalo keia, kuulei aloha ya okopakaya pau, aloha.
That was singer and songwriter Kalani Pea and the Conversations' D.W. Gibson. They were talking about his latest album, Ku'ini, which earned the performer his fourth Grammy Award for Best Regional Roots Music Album. He'll be performing in California in the coming weeks, first in Carmel by the Sea on February 28th, and then in Tracy on March 1st. He returns to the Hawaii Theater on May 3rd for the 7th annual May Day is Lay Day in Hawaii concert. Vai pahe kawaine O ohi kalei Kalei lehiwa Kalei mahi Now it's time to reveal the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we told you about the first lawyer to pass the bar exam in Braille. The idea to become a lawyer first came to him after watching Perry Mason grilling the bad guys on TV. He knew it was his rhetorical skills, not his eyesight, that would matter the most. Recently, reflecting on all of his accomplishments, this McKinley High School grad said, "All of my life, I have just seen blindness more as an inconvenience, not as a disability." He overcame the inconvenience to enjoy a career in law spanning nearly a half a century, aided by a machine that translates legal documents into Braille. And his journey into politics lasted 16 years. After initially winning a seat in the Hawaii House of Representatives in 1982, he served in that chamber until 1998. Since then, he might have stepped out of the political spotlight, but he still practices law, and every now and then he plays the piano at a few retirement homes. The name of this retiring, or this pioneering lawyer and lawmaker is none other than Terrence Tom. And congrats to our winner, Julian Lipscher. He knew the answer because he worked at the Department of Health, and he would go before Terry Tom's committee at the legislature. Thanks so much for calling in, Julian. But that's our quiz. If you have an idea for one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. That does it for us today. Tomorrow, we get the latest on the program to return homeless to the mainland, why lawmakers want to expand the initiative. Share your comments or questions about what you heard by calling our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.